So we're getting towards the end of our series on justice, and today I'm speaking on the subject of justice and creation. Now, if all has gone according to plan, before this sermon you will have heard a reading, and that reading would have been 1 Corinthians 13, verses 1 to 7, quite a well-known passage about love. And you may say, well, what's that passage got to do with the topic of justice and creation? I might understand what it's got to do with justice, maybe, but justice and creation. Well, hopefully by the end of my sermon, you'll see where I'm going with this. But I just want to say, I'm actually going to come at this maybe from a slightly different angle than you might be expecting, a talk about creation and justice to go on. I may cover a lot of the things you may expect me to cover, but I'm going to take a slightly different approach when I go through this sermon. Well, the first thing I want to say, though, is to share with you that when I was researching this sermon, I read an article that I thought very helpfully kind of defined an Old Testament understanding of justice in terms of particularly this topic, because we thought a lot about what justice is. And this article suggested that one of the sort of defining Old Testament characteristics of justice is that it's about balance, and it's about not exploiting those that you can exploit. The Old Testament never suggests that, you know, everyone should have the same and justice is everyone being exactly the same. The Old Testament acknowledges that not everyone is the same. Some people have more, some people have less. Some people have, you know, we all have different talents, abilities, we have different resources, we have different things given to us. And the point of justice is that those who have should not exploit those who don't have. Those who have sort of resources and power and authority should not take advantage of those who don't have those things. And that's sort of the way to think about justice. And I think particularly in these terms, when we're thinking about creation, that makes sense, doesn't it? The justice and creation, understanding justice as being about balance and not taking advantage of and not exploiting someone or something just because you can. And the Old Testament actually gives the impression that God is concerned about justice, not just for people, but for all that he has created. Here's one of the Old Testament laws he gives his people. I'm reading from Exodus 23, verses 10 to 11. For 6 years, you are to sow your fields and harvest the crops. But during the seventh year, let the land lie unploughed and unused. Then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what is left. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. Notice there that God essentially says, you know what, give your land a rest. It's not just people that need rest. I want you to give land a rest. And notice how it ties in with justice for people, because God says, you know, things that grow on there, they're not yours. You don't harvest them. Let the land sort of rest. But anything that grows belongs to the poor and the wild animals. The same command is given in Leviticus 25. Verses 3 to 7, but there it's explicitly said, you know, the seventh year is the year the land is to have a year of Sabbath rest. So God wants the land to rest, not just you, not just me, but what he has created. He wants that to rest too. And in fact, God goes so far, and you in the next chapter in Leviticus 26, God says, look, if you don't keep these laws that I give you, you'll be carried off into exile. You'll be conquered and carried off into exile, which is what happened to the people of Israel. They were taken into exile in Babylon. The Jewish kingdom, southern kingdom, was taken into exile in Babylon. And in Leviticus 26, it says, you know, if this happens, then the land will enjoy its Sabbath years all the time that it lies desolate and you are in the country of your enemies. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. All the time that it lies desolate, the land will have the rest it did not have during the Sabbaths you lived in it. So God actually says, and as I say, they were carried into exile in Babylon, and the land lied desolate for 70 years. And God says, well, one of the things that does is that gives the land the rest you did not give it by not keeping my laws. So God takes this seriously, this idea of giving land rest. But it's not just land that God cares about. There's a Old Testament law that from Deuteronomy 25 verse 4 that some of you may be familiar with, but not because you know Deuteronomy really well. The law is, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. And if you're familiar with that, wager it's more likely that you're familiar with it because Paul quotes it to Timothy in his first letter to Timothy in chapter 5. And what's that law all about? Do not muzzle an ox while it is treading the grain. Well, if you've got an ox and you've put it to work treading your grain, grinding your grain, what's an ox going to do when it's hungry and surrounded by all this grain? It's going to eat some of it. It's going to eat as it works. And if you might say, well, it's my grain, I don't want the oxen to eat any of it, it's all mine. So you put a muzzle on your oxen so it can't eat the grain. But the Old Testament law is, no, don't do that. This animal that's working for you should be able to enjoy the fruits of its labor just as you are. This animal should not be denied benefiting from the work it's doing, which is why Paul quotes it to Timothy when he's talking about church leaders and those who preach and teach and saying, make sure they're sort of looked after and reimbursed for the work they do, because, you know, even an oxen should benefit from the work it does, you know, and even a preacher should be allowed to benefit from the work that he does. So the principle behind this law is that God actually thinks that there should be justice for the created order, not just for people, but for the land and the animals as too. God is concerned about seeing justice work throughout the whole of creation, everything he's created. And Paul is not shy of reminding us that God's agenda is not just the redemption of people, which is what we sometimes think, but it's the redemption of the whole of creation. He says in Romans 8, starting at verse 18, he says, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that we will be revealed in us. So we might be familiar with that section. He goes on in verse 19, for the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. So one of the things Paul says, look, when you and I, as the children of God, and as we build the kingdom, one of the things that should be happening is that the whole of creation should be liberated from decay as well. That God's agenda is not just the salvation of people, but the salvation of his world. So all of this, I think, suggests quite strongly that God cares about the world he created, not just the people who live in this world, but the actual world he created. And he wants justice for the world too, that the land should be able to rest, that animals should not be deprived of the fruits of their labor, that the creation should rejoice and be liberated by our salvation, not just, you know, us. And I think one of the problems we have in our culture, in our society, in the Western world, the developed Western world where many of us live, one of the big problems we have is that our systems, our lifestyles are not really about balance. They are really about exploitation. We are really concerned with exploiting what we can and building systems that maximize efficiency, that get the most for the least amount of effort. And when our goal is to be efficient, to be as efficient as possible in getting the most we can, then things like balance and justice tend to play second fiddle, tend to fall out the window. And the problem is that God has a different way of thinking. God, for one thing, doesn't think about efficiency the way that you and I would think about it. In one of the commands, I've referred to this in one of my previous sermons, I think on that being the sermon I spoke about, the marginalized, is there's this Old Testament law of gleaning, where if you have a field and you harvest it, you leave the edge of your field in order to help the poor can come and get food from the edge of your field. Now, that's not really something we would think about when we're sort of harvesting our crops, whatever form that takes, because it's inefficient, it's wasteful. But God says, no, it's loving. It's loving. And that's what God tends to prioritise. And God can be efficient, but even when God is being efficient, he has a totally different mindset to you and I. He approaches things totally differently to the way that you and I understand what the point of efficiency is. So for us, it's about saving time. For us, it's about maximising our return, our investment for our benefit. God has a different understanding of what it means to be efficient. For example, in Acts chapter 8, we read about Philip, and he speaks to the Ethiopian eunuch. I hope you're familiar with this story. He just starts talking to an Ethiopian eunuch who's quite high up in the sort of royal court, quite an important person. And he gets talking to Philip on the road, and he's trying to understand a passage from the book of Isaiah, and Philip explains the passage to him and shares the gospel with him, and this Ethiopian decides to follow Jesus and gets baptized there, sort of on the road, in a puddle or a stream or whatever by the roadside. And then we read at the end of that story that Philip is sort of taken away by the Spirit. He's just gone. And he ends up at a place called Azotus, and he goes around preaching the gospel. And we're told sort of at the end of chapter 8, he finally ends up in a place called Caesarea. That's where he is. And then a chapter later, at the beginning of chapter 10, we read, this is a new story, you know, start a new paragraph and everything like that, a new chapter. And we read about an Italian, a Gentile centurion who belongs to the Italian regiment, called Cornelius. And Cornelius isn't a Jew, and he's not familiar with the gospel, but he's desperate. He's desperate to please God. He's desperate to serve God. And God decides, this is the guy who I'm going to, you know, bring into my kingdom and throw open this whole idea that Gentiles can become Christians without needing to convert to Judaism. Like, this is a big deal, what happens in Acts chapter 10. Now, where does Cornelius live? He lives in Caesarea. And you and I, we might think, oh, Cornelius lives in Caesarea. And you know who else is in Caesarea? Philip. Philip's in Caesarea. And Philip, you know, we think, wow, what an amazing plan God has. Look at God's provision we've got a guy who needs to hear the gospel, and he's not a Jew, and we have Philip, who is Philip the evangelist. He shares the gospel, that's what he does, and he has no problem sharing the gospel with non-Jews, because he's done it already to an Ethiopian eunuch, and we think, that's amazing, look at God's plan, what a God incidence, or whatever we'd say like that. Because we think that would be efficient. You've got a guy who needs the gospel, and you've got someone who can share the gospel, and they're in the same place. Great, get on with it, God. But God's agenda is different. What does God say to Cornelius? He doesn't say, look, you're in luck. There's a guy around the corner called Philip. He can sort it all out. He says to Cornelius, send for Peter in Joppa. Now, Joppa is over 30 miles away. This is not efficient God. This is not making the best use of your resources. But this is the point. God is not thinking of efficiency in terms like this. When God thinks about efficiency, he's thinking, how can I improve the lot of as many people as possible with one act? How can I make it so we don't just bring Cornelius into the church, and we don't just throw open the gates of heaven to the Gentiles as well, but we also teach Peter a little something about this whole thing, because Peter has a problem with this idea of Gentiles becoming Christians without first accepting Judaism. Peter has a problem. So God says, go and get Peter, because this is God's understanding of efficiency. It's different to ours. It's not about saving time. It's about saving people. It's not about maximizing the sort of bang for our buck as quickly as possible. It's about maximizing love. That is God's agenda. Because you and I sometimes think about efficiency in terms of maximizing productivity, value for money, saving time, we miss that actually the call is to be just and to treat creation with justice. Even if that means you've got a year where a field is just laying there doing nothing. We get finally we get to 1 Corinthians 13. This is the what it means to love. This passage outlines what it means to be loving. And we are used to thinking about this in terms of how we relate to people. But to be men and women who not just, you know, are loving, but who model love in all aspects of our lives, we need to think broader about this. For example, love is what? It doesn't say love is efficient, because love is most definitely not efficient. It says love is patient. That's the first thing. And that should give us a clue straight away. Patient people are not necessarily efficient people, because patient people are prepared to wait. Patient people are prepared to sit around waiting, not necessarily working. Patient people are prepared to possibly waste their time and money because it may be inefficient, but it is the loving thing to do. This is God's agenda. And I think sometimes one of the dangers is that we fall into this worldly mindset of prizing efficiency over love. And all that, we do these things where we think we're being loving, but really we are just being efficient. And I'll tell you a little story of something that happened to me once that I think illustrates this. When I was a student in London, I went to quite a big church, quite a well-known church, and fantastic preacher. The minister of the church was probably the best preacher I've ever heard. He was quite famous, quite well-known. He wrote books, all that kind of stuff, and he was a fantastic preacher. And the first time I went to this church, they had, you know, we've got in Barton, do you remember when we used to meet together as a church and someone from the front would talk about the next step cards, and you could fill out those cards if you were a visitor to get more information, or if you just wanted to say, no, I'm not a visitor, but I want to get more involved with this or that. Well, the church I went to had welcome cards. Cards like that, where you filled out your details. And so my first Sunday there, so I filled out my details, my name, my address, and so on. And then later that week, I got home to my wherever, my halls of residence, and there was a letter for me. And I opened this letter, and it was a letter from the church, and the letter said, "Dear James, it was great to see you there on Sunday. Hope to see you again. Do not hesitate to get in touch." And the icing on the cake was that it was signed. And it wasn't signed by, you know, some rubbishy elder or anything like that. No, it was signed by the minister, this great man, this fantastic preacher, this incredible author. He'd signed this letter. "Great to see you there on Sunday, James. Hope to see you again. Do not hesitate to get in touch." That, I can't tell you how awesome that felt to receive a letter like that, sort of signed from this by this guy I respected and looked up to. It made me feel loved. it made me feel important or significant. It made me feel how I should feel, you know, being part of the people of God. Well, so I went back to that church next Sunday. Of course I did. And here's the thing. You need to understand something, okay? I hadn't been a Christian very long. And the church I'd been involved in previously was kind of the first church that I'd really been involved in. And they had welcome cards too. But their welcome cards were slightly different. As in, you filled them out and you handed them in every week. And the purpose was that then they could see, you know, if people were not there, if someone had been missing church, not because they wanted, you know, where you haven't been to church, but in case there was a pastoral need they need to take care of. They just, and it was a way of keeping, you know, seeing how many people were coming and things like that. So you filled out a welcome card every week. That was what you did on in the church I'd come from. So like an idiot, when I went to this church the second time, what did I do? I filled out a welcome card again. And I handed it in again because I thought that's what you did. And you know what happened, don't you? That week, I get home to my halls of residence and there's a letter for me. And I open this letter and what does this letter say? It says, "Dear James, it was great to see you there on Sunday. Hope to see you again. Do not hesitate to get in touch. Signed again by this great man." How did I feel the second time I received that letter? Exact same letter, carbon copy of that first letter. I felt deflated. I realised what had gone on here. This letter wasn't really from, you know, a human being. "Great to see you there on Sunday." They hadn't even noticed that I'd been there. They'd not even noticed that the same idiot was filling out a card for the second week in a row. They just send this pro forma letter out, and I felt like rubbish, to be honest. It was a system, that's all it was. It was an attempt to be efficient. And that is the problem with using systems as a way of trying to love people, is that all it takes is for one idiot to come along and fill out a welcome card 2 weeks in a row and your machine explodes in a shower of cogs and springs and nuts and bolts. Because love is not about systems or being efficient. Love actually makes people feel like they have been noticed. Love actually makes people feel like they are significant and they do matter. And you cannot love efficiently, but because by its nature, love means maybe sacrifice. Love means being patient. Love means sometimes just waiting around in the hope that something might happen, and it doesn't happen, but it doesn't matter anyway because that's what it means to be loving at times. Love means sometimes wasting your time, wasting your money, wasting your resources because it is the right thing to do, regardless of whether it's efficient, regardless of whether it's a good use of your resources. I hope you were paying attention when Oz spoke about generosity a few weeks ago, because I think one of the things he shared we could probably identify with is sometimes you get requests for money and your immediate response is not sure if that's, you know, a legitimate request, not sure if that's wise, not sure if that's an efficient use of my money. Will I get much spiritual return from this? Maybe you're missing the point. Because love is not about efficiency. Love is about maximizing love. It is about making beggars feel like kings. And so what does this way of thinking about love have to do with creation? All these things Paul says about love, what does that have to do with creation? Well, if you prize efficiency above all, God and you're not on the same page. And I'm sure many of you know what it's like to work somewhere, whether it's, you know, the NHS or in schools or something like that, where really efficiency is prized above actually doing your job well. Because if you do your job well, If you love people, that's part of your job. It's sometimes inefficient. It means you spend twice as long talking to someone when you could have spoken to three people in that time and ticked three names off your list. That is the most efficient thing to do. But God does not prize efficiency above all. And if you have this way of thinking about love, how does that impact the way you think about how we relate to the world around us? Apply this way of thinking not just to people, but to creation, to the world around you. Do you see the world around you as something that exists to be exploited, to get as much as we can from it, as efficiently as we can, regardless of whether or not it's good for creation or good for future generations? And if you adopt this mindset, then maybe we might have to do something, but we might have to rethink the way we relate to creation. Well, how do you do that? There are just two things I'm going to suggest in closing. I mean, in one sense, this is easy, because this kind of topic, looking after creation, relating creation, this is a live issue. This is on the hearts and minds of people out there. You know, we've have the young people taking days off school in order to protest about climate change. You know, for young people, this is a genuine issue. They're genuinely concerned about the future, about how to relate to the world. And the good news for us who are not young is that therefore, there's loads of resources out there. If you really want to know how you can love the world around you better, then it's easy. Just look it up. And I will say, because one of the problems we have sometimes we think, you know, the people on the cutting edge of caring for creation are not necessarily people who would share our views on the centrality of Christ and things like that. You know, if you're my age, you might remember Greenpeace and the Rainbow Warrior and Swampy and people like that. And you may think, oh, I'm not sure. Well, you know, for one thing, I'd say all truth is God's truth, so don't worry so much about it. But I would also say, why don't you search, not for environmentalism or something like that, but for have a look for creation justice. I've noticed when I'm doing my own research, there are a lot of Christian groups who are approaching these same sort of topics, climate change and things so on, but from the sort of the heading of creation justice, to emphasize the fact that this is about being a follower of Christ. This is about loving the world as God loved the world. You know, that's their motivation, that's their agenda. So that's the first thing I would say, is you can just plenty of resources on there, and you know, have a look at them and maybe think, well, let's just pick one, because there's a lot out there. But if you really want something to do, here's an interesting one that I could actually suggest. A few years ago I preached on the topic of fasting, and as is my want, my own particular bias, most of that sermon was concerned about fasting as a spiritual discipline and its benefits to our relationship with God and others. But I've also realized, while I've been thinking about this and preparing this sermon, that fasting is actually a way of expressing creation justice. It's a way of loving the world. It is a way of saying, well, let's give the fields a Sabbath rest. And if I just fast for 24 hours, that is one day where I am not demanding food from the creation, from the world around me. Now, let's be realistic. No, there's no factory there that's going to say, right, let's shut up shop for the day and send everyone home. James isn't eating hobnobs today. Or, you know, there's no farmer who's going to stop farming just because I or one people or five people or 10 people are fasting for a day. But that's not the point. That's never the point. You know, the point is always, are you doing what you think God has called you to do? That's really the question. Are you doing something? Are you making an effort? And just for a bit of time, are you giving the world around you a rest? Or are you giving creation some love, if I could put it like that? And fasting, I think, I've realised, is a way of doing this. And it, you know, maybe you think about even something like, well, I'm going to walk I'm going to fast from using my car today. I'm going to walk instead of driving. Things like that are a way of giving creation rest. And it kind of makes me smile. I think, isn't this great? That God's given us all these spiritual disciplines. And actually, some of them are a way of loving not just ourselves and not just building our relationship with God, but a way of loving the world God has created as well, loving the world around us. Isn't that amazing? It's almost as if it was planned. It was almost as if someone sort of was thinking about these things when they came up with spiritual disciplines. So that's an example, and again, you can think of other things possibly, or other ways of just in a way expressing a commitment to justice for creation. But really, the principle I'm asking you to consider is to take these things in 1 Corinthians 13 and think not just how can I apply these to my relationships with people, but how can I apply these things. And you can read them and look at them. How can I apply these things to my relationship with the created order, with the world around me, the world that God has made, the world that God loves?